Ladies and gentlemen, please note this podcast carries a taste and decency warning. Some of the items discussed in this program are of an explicit yet scientific nature relating to sex and particularly penises. Listeners are advised to use their discretion, but it should be noted it's likely to be highly entertaining.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. On this week's Penisology podcast, we tell you everything you never wanted to know about sex.
The females will prefer to mate with a virgin male because a virgin male can produce a sperm packet that's 15% of his body weight.
We always insist on having a Nobel Prize winner on the programme. This fella's quite good at chemistry.
I think science education in the US has fallen way back. And I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate, and I think it will have long-term consequences.
As the Conservative Party in the UK makes its pitch to win the next election, we ask, what would that mean for British science?
A plan to keep the lights on, a plan to reduce our emissions, a plan to create jobs in the low-carbon economy, a plan to give Britain leadership again in this growing international market.
Plus, we live-blog the past, as it were, as NASA finds a new way of disposing of its space junk by sending it hurtling into the moon surface.
All stations flight, 5 minutes to Centaur impact.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, I'm Nell Bowes, standing in for Alok Jar again. My Guardian chum joining me in the studio this week is Ian Sample.
Hi, Nell.
Hello, Ian. And environment correspondent David Adam will be making an appearance later. Now, we tackle all kinds of subjects in this podcast. Oh, this is going to get worse and worse. Meaty ones like creationism, life after death, and only last week we were discussing extrasolar planets and dark energy. But this week we're looking at something, let's say, lighter. Some might say childish, but whatever. It's no less scientific. It's the knobs bit of the Nobels. Dr. Ed Sykes is here, who, according to my notes, is an animal sexpert. Ed, is that strictly true?
It'll do for now.
Hello, it's very nice to have you on the podcast. Ed is a zoologist with a PhD in evolutionary biology. He won an award for his video podcast about the sex lives of bedbugs, and he currently works for the Science Media Centre. I was casually leafing through the upcoming events at University College London and spotted your lecture on the 15th of October. I don't know why it jumped out at me. It's called Penisology. The blurb says it's a weird and wonderful world of sex, a frank discussion about the battle of the sexes and the sordid techniques males and females use to get one over on each other, as it were. Needless to say, we had to get you into the studio. It would be nice to talk about the animals first, I think, and get on to the humans later. Tell me, what is penisology? Why?
It's a very, very good question. Why? Well, basically, I was given the title and just told to fill it with whatever I could come up with. So this all came about because of Vivian Parry, who used to be the presenter on Tomorrow's World, who did an amazing piece on vibrators and road tested them, effectively, a large number, for Good Housekeeping Guide and the Cheltenham Science Festival. And she was then involved with working out what should be on this year's festival, and came up with the idea of penisology, and they thought around and thought of me. Make of that what you will.
Was it a natural choice?
Well, yeah, I think it was because of the bed bugs thing. I think it had left a little bit of a scar in their minds. So, yeah, they asked me to come into that. And I jumped at the chance because I do love talking about sex.
So why? What do you talk about?
Well, there's just so many weird and crazy things. When I was doing my undergrad, I was working with a guy called Mike Sivajothi, who's fantastic when it comes to bed bugs and so on, and that's where I first got involved in all this. Now, bed bugs, everyone kind of thinks them as fairly squeamish, like, because they spend their time crawling about on the bed and crawling onto your body and basically feeding off your blood, which isn't particularly pleasant to start with. But what's worse is when you actually start to hear a little bit more about them, because these bed bugs, they're kind of very small little creatures, and the males and females kind of like live in the dried blood and stuff that's crusty around the side of your beds and so on, and behind the wallpaper and bits and pieces. And the males are spending their time trying to inseminate the females. They're trying to have sex with them. And the females quite often don't want to, you know, perhaps they're not that fancying that particular male bed bug. And what they can do is they can kind of like, they're built a bit like tanks with like a V shape to the bottom of them. So they can lean to one side and stop the males from actually inseminating them. They can't get their penis in, effectively. But the problem is that females have to feed if they want to make eggs. So they've got to crawl out onto your body, And whilst you're sleeping, they'll start to put their mouth part into you and take all the blood in. And when they do, they swell up like a blimp. Now, normally, they're fairly well protected by like these armour plate strips that are on their backs and so on. But when they swell up, they kind of like expose the soft tissue underneath, which means that the males get their chance. And the males have like a hypodermic needle of a penis. So they can literally clamber onto the female and stab the penis anywhere into the body of the female and inseminate her. And the sperm will swim around to the place to fertilise the eggs. It's brilliant. But the problem is that for the female is that not only are these penises kind of like not necessarily all that healthy because they don't spend their time in the fairly dirty conditions, but there can be lots and lots of these males trying to do this at once, like 15, 20 of them. And it can, you know, reduce her lifespan by like a quarter. So she really, really doesn't like this, but there's not much she can do about it in many of the species, although some of them have developed some kind of like protection.
I'm slightly stunned, but it just seems quite childish of bed bugs. I mean, it's like one thing to come out at night and start eating off you, but to then think, well, while we're here, we might as well have sex as well. It just seems a bit sort of teenage to me, but, you know, hats off. I was quite interested about stick insects, though, because I noticed that they seem to have sex solidly for 2 weeks. I mean, is that why they're so thin?
It's a good question. No, I think that's so they look even more sticky. But the reason they end up doing it for quite so long is that the males are basically spending their time trying to stop other males from getting in there. So you've got... Everyone kind of thinks that females spend their time just wanting to have sex with like one partner, raise the kids, so on, and be done with it, and that males go off and sleep around. But in fact, there's loads and loads of really good reasons to why females of many species might want to sleep around, effectively. I mean, there's reasons like prostitution, good parenting, good genes, and so on. I can talk about all of those, but the reason that, because of all this, the males have to come up with all these different techniques for how they can stop the females from getting their way. So in stick insects, what they do is they effectively clamp on to the female and she has to carry them around for 2 weeks, having sex that no other male can.
But the driver in all of these different processes is to get your genes down into the next generation, isn't it? I mean, so when you're talking about kind of prostitution and things like that, it's completely analogous, or it's an analogy rather than putting too human ethic. You don't want to put too much of a sort of human ethical spin on any of these processes, do you?
No, but it's... They literally are often having sex for resources. So, I mean...
So give us an example.
Okay, one really good example is the green-veined white butterfly. Okay, mm-hmm. And in that case, the females will prefer to mate with a virgin male because a virgin male can produce a sperm packet that's 15% of his body weight. So if you think about that, I mean, if you're, you know, 60 kilos or whatever, that's a hell of a lot of sperm that comes out. And the reason is that so much of all the stuff that's packaged in with the sperm in the sperm package is food. And the female can actually use that to live longer, produce more eggs and so on. So if she mates with a male who's not a virgin, he can't put all that effort into it. So she ends up meeting with some others and gets more chance. I mean, another type of prostitution is that, so there's like the red-winged blackbird, which will effectively want other males to help defend its nest. So the female will end up sleeping around and then the males can hopefully come and try and, you know, defend the nest if any predators come calling. But of course, then she's got to balance it up because she doesn't want the other males to know that she's sleeping with lots of them because then they might leave her and not help raise the chicks and so on. So the males are always trying to make sure that they're not actually being cuckolded, basically. Although there is one really interesting case, actually, where the females really don't give a shit what the males do because they're in control. So in Panama, there are these types of birds called jacanas. In this area of Panama, there are so many crocodiles around that everyone's pretty quite surprised that you even get jacanas around. Because what happens is, you'd imagine you get the female on a nest, some of the chicks hatch, go out, bang, get eaten by the crocodile. And they just can't basically produce them quickly enough. So what's ended up happening there is that the males end up rearing the chicks. So they have a nest. So basically you'll have lots and lots of males making a nest, sitting around waiting for a female to come along and lay her eggs in their nest. And she effectively has her own harem of males and wanders around, beats up the other females, stops them from licking them, goes off and wins more territory and some more males and so on. Literally completely turn the tables.
Are you able to draw any conclusions from all of these wild and wacky tales? Are you able to kind of shed light on different processes, or have you managed to overturn any assumptions that people have made about why sex happens in the way it does?
Well, for me, the biggest kind of eye-opener was the fact that there aren't really any rigid rules about males do this, females do that. it's all a game. It's all a big game, and there are different ways of playing it. You've got the female way, which is to put lots of energy into producing eggs, and the male way, which is to produce lots and lots of sperm. But once you've got that starting point, then there's a whole different way in which you can play it. So females, obviously, if they've only got a few eggs, they might want to say, right, I'm only going to let the very, very best males fertilise it. Whereas the males might go, well, I'm going to sleep with absolutely everything that's around because I may as well. I've got all these sperm. I can just chuck them off willy-nilly. I really don't care where they go. You know, something will work out. But then if the females start becoming more and more kind of like choosy and so on, then the males have to become more and more impressive to try and get over that. And so there's this fight going on the whole time until the point where the males end up literally only sleeping around once. I mean, there's even the case whereby the females really do become the top dog in species where the females often eat the males. And that
is that
really
kind of we're looking
no
at spiders at that point?
Spiders mainly. So, I mean, it basically comes down to the fact that if you are a female, you'd think, well, what's the point in eating your lover? Well, it may even make sense to try and eat them before you've mated with them, because you'd imagine that, fine, once you've mated them, you want to have the kids and so on. But if you end up if you basically eat any males that come towards you, then you're weeding out the crap ones, because if they can't
get
past your...
And just using them as resource.
Yeah, if they can't get past your defence, then, you know, they're a bit weedy, and so just eat them anyway, as long as you're not getting rid of all of them, because then obviously you wouldn't get mated and you wouldn't have any children at all. So there's, yeah, as you said, spiders are often one of the cases where this happens. I think there's about 80 species where females end up eating their partners. One of the ones that I like is the biting midge, whereby what happens is the midge, normally the female will just kind of stab her proboscis into an insect they're going to feed on. And when it comes to the male has to get underneath her to mate with her. And so what she does is she stabs her proboscis into the top of his head and effectively puts in this goo and stuff, which turns his innards into a liquid that she can then suck up through her straw. And, you know, he hopefully has had a chance to mate with her, and his penis actually breaks off inside her as well, just to add insult to injury. Which is, you know, not
sort of to
pleasant.
Ensure that she's got the sperm at that point.
Yeah, well, so in that case, she's got the sperm. But with lots of these spiders, they might end up, as I said, eating the partner before they get a chance to mate. So the males will have to do whatever they can to try and get around this. There's a number of cases where spiders do things like they'll actually try and tie the female down, go into bondage, and tie them down so they can actually inseminate them and get away with it. Or there's the wolf spider, which they actually try and like kick her and stuff and beat her up a bit, which can be really difficult to do because the females are often so much bigger than the males. But there's one really, really interesting case, actually. The Australian redback is one of the most famous ones, where they were looking at this case and they were seeing that the a male was about to be eaten by a female. And then suddenly another male runs up, grabs the male out of the jaws of the female that's about to eat him, takes him away to safety, trusses him up in silk, and then went and stood in his place, in her jaws. And you're like, that's really, really odd.
What, after the original spider was mated?
Well, no, before it mated, actually.
Okay.
But grabbed him out of the place, went and got in the jaws instead, and basically somersaulted his body and said, look, eat me. And it was all a bit odd, but what's going on is that the male, they've got like pedipalps, which are little straws, effectively, by the side of their head that they can store their sperm in. And what he's doing is, by somersaulting, he can reach his pedipalps down to her to fertilise her. And he's basically saying, look, the longer that you spend eating me, the more time I get inseminating you, yeah, with my sperm. And it kind of still doesn't make much sense. You're like, well, surely it's worth, you know, trying again with another female. But it's because then webs are so hard to get between them, there's basically zero chance of doing it. So they only get one shot with one female. So they want to inseminate and fertilise as many of her eggs as they can, because they don't want the other males to do it. So get rid of the others and sacrifice yourself.
Ian, you have a slightly odd look on your face at this point.
Yeah, who wouldn't? It's fascinating stuff. But the one question I can't get out of my mind is there in the animal kingdom the equivalent of like a shaft, like, you know, the sort of the finely honed top evolution sex machine?
Oh, shaft.
Shaft, as in the...
See, my brain was going a completely different way then.
The guy with the leather jacket.
Yeah. No, it was the
and
musical
the
note that really helped.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want a male lover that has more offspring than anyone else.
If it helps, he once said, I feel like a machine. That's no way for a man to feel. Anyway,
having a terrifying insight into Ian's psyche here.
Well, actually, possibly the most efficient in one way would be something like the male Chicana or a male seahorse.
Is that what you'd want to be, though?
No, not at all. Obviously, that's... To me, that's quite a boring life. But what they get is the males get hold of the female's eggs and store them themselves. So they get to make sure that every single one of the eggs is fertilised by them. Whereas most of the time, there's a lot of guessing. But if you want to think of a male that has...
Sounds like more like New Man, that seahorse than Shaft. I'm not sure that...
Well, indeed. But if you're talking about the most efficient, then, you know, that's the way that you really know that you're going to actually fertilise all the eggs. But if you're talking about a male that ends up possibly having the most fun, and this isn't just for the males, it's for females as well, but there's the bonobo, which everyone uses as an example. Yeah. They really go at it literally every single way you can think of. Very gregarious, and everyone kind of wonders why. A lot of it, they believe, might be down to social bonding. Obviously, we look to our close relatives when we're trying to work out, you know, what's going on and the reason why we do certain things. And often you see with, like, chimps and so on, that they will end up, the females will mate with lots of males, partly, they think, to confuse who the father is. So it literally is a case of who's the daddy, because they want to make sure that the males who are top dog aren't going to be annoyed that they're not fathering this child and kill it. Or that they want to get the help getting food and so on. So by sleeping around, then they get this all confusion in the air, so no one knows who the daddy is, and they all want to chip in just in case they are.
Fascinating tactics. I think that might be just bad enough for us for now. We'll come back to you at the end of the programme, Ed, and maybe have a chat about human sex. Apparently, Andy says the word threesomes may crop up, but I'll leave that for now. For all the details about Ed's lecture on the 15th of October, go to ucl.ac.uk. Science Weekly. The Nobel Prizes have been handed out this week, so let's take a look at the Science Awards. The Nobel Prize for Medicine has been shared by three scientists for work on ageing and cancer. The US trio discovered how chromosomes are protected. It's also the first time the prize has honoured two women at the same time. Ian, it's all about the tips of shoelaces, isn't it?
Well, it's a handy analogy. I mean, the prize was awarded for these structures called telomeres, which essentially... extra bits of DNA, kind of caps, if you like, that go on the ends of chromosomes that essentially stop them fraying with age as cells divide. If you look at how long people's telomeres are, it's kind of gives you an idea of how old they are, because telomeres do wear down with age. But essentially, if you can keep them intact, then your cells don't really age. And so the interesting thing is, obviously, people, scientists ran, you know, with their hands above their heads, thinking, you know, we can start working on aging cures, if you want to call aging a disease. But what's interesting, you then hit a kind of, you know, you're on an interesting fence, because on one side you have, do we want to try and keep these telomeres intact and to protect chromosomes in cells all the way through life and extend life? But if you try and do that by, say, bolstering activity of the enzyme that makes telomeres, you can turn cells into being immortal, which you might think would be great, but obviously immortal cells are cancer. So indirectly, this work has led to all sorts of interesting ways of looking at and understanding different types of tumour.
Now, on to physics. Again, awarded to three people, three men this time. Woolwich Polytechnic has its first Nobel laureate, the Briton Charles Kwun Kau. He pioneered fibre optic communications. George Smith and Willard Boyle share the prize for their work on charge coupled devices. The Woolwich Polytechnic seems to be having a good year. Who else has been issuing from its doors?
Well, it's interesting. Woolwich Polytechnic, a lot of people don't think it really ever existed, but it did, and it turned into Thames Poly, and then it turned into the University of Greenwich in 1992. But what's interesting, if you look through the University of Greenwich alumni, they include all of the Thames Poly and the Woolwich Poly people who ever came to anything. And there are amazing people on that list. There's the guy who formerly managed the railways pensions. There's another guy who was formerly the chairman of Falkirk United. And there's another man on there who is arguably the most influential Christian singer-songwriter of his generation. But now they have their first Nobel laureate, and hats off to them. I mean, you know, he is a brilliant guy. I mean, he went from, we have a laugh on the Woolwich Polytechnic because we're snobby, but, you know, he went on to do a PhD at Imperial. There's also a lovely bit that he went to work at a phone company in Essex, but it turned out it was Nortel and he was head of research there. And then he went on to be at one of the major universities in Hong Kong. But yeah, I mean, he is the guy who worked out that when other people were trying to send information down glass fibers, they were getting it to go tens of meters. He worked out how you could send it hundreds of kilometers. The other guys are interesting as well. I mean, they produce these charge-coupled devices, which are essentially the early-ish kinds. They're still used, but they're early kinds of sort of digital camera elements. They're basically the sort of the eye part of the camera, if you like. basically what between them, these three people, gave us what we needed for this whole information and communications-based society.
And now for chemistry, three people again, two men and a woman, one of whom is Cambridge scientist who has shown how proteins are made in cells, Venkatraman Ramakrishnan. He shares the prize with Ada Yonat and Thomas Stites for elucidating how cells make proteins. Ian spoke to Professor Stites from the studios on campus at Yale.
Well, I was in bed. It was at 5:25 a.m. and they called, and it was very nice. Great wake-up call.
I don't know whether scientists who are aware that they've done very important work are sort of like children that on Christmas Eve when it comes to the night before the Nobels, and whether they sort of have trouble sleeping and all that sort of thing.
I didn't have trouble sleeping. I had thought, well, maybe I'll get a call in the morning, but since it hadn't happened for a number of years, you know, you don't lie awake worrying about it.
I think every year when it comes to Nobel Week, there's the idea arises where there's always a discussion about whether the Nobels are fit for purpose. And normally that conversation seems to revolve around, is this limit of three names outdated, especially because science is getting more complicated and you have collaborations with more and more people. But this year, before the awards were announced, there were some high-profile scientists writing to the Academy and saying that they also need to introduce more categories. So for things like environmental science, for public health. And the people behind that were sort of E.O. Wilson, Franz de Waal, Emery, Peter Raven at Missouri Botanical Gardens. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, whether the Nobel system almost is needs updating?
Well, it's always hard to give somebody else advice on this matter, but I do think it is a challenge, because it is definitely always the case these days that there are far more pivotally important people who contribute to a discovery than can be adequately awarded in this prize. And I think it would be awfully nice to be able to recognize that in some way. And certainly the number of fields of science that have a major impact and importance has changed in the last 100 years. And so it would be nice to have recognition of those other areas.
It was a really good crop of Nobel Prizes for the US this year. I know they're not over yet, but as far as science is concerned, they are. What is your view of science in the US today? I mean, certainly with the arrival of Obama, there was a lot of excitement, certainly in this country, and I'm sure in the US and elsewhere. But what is your view of the sort of the health of science at the moment, a year in?
Well, I heard Obama talk at the National Academy in March, and he's extraordinarily inspiring, I must say. And his ideas about what he wants to do with science education are terrific. I just hope he's able to implement them. I think science education in the U.S. has fallen way back, and I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate, and I think it will have long-term consequences, unless it's reversed. Very, very important thing to do. I mean, I was inspired, for example, by the Sputnik episode and the call to young people to get into science and meet the challenge. And so I think many of us were inspired by that and went into science. And I think that's needed again.
Just finally, before I let you get on, have you had any thoughts about where to put your prize winnings yet? What will you be treating yourself to?
Oh, I don't know. Well, it's a question I've been asked, and I frankly haven't thought about it, to be quite honest. The money is always nice. Everybody likes money, but it's not the primary goal here. I'll probably contribute some money, and I'll come up with some ideas.
Ian speaking to Professor Thomas Stites there, one of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Ed, what do you make of the controversy that we seem to always get around the Nobels this time?
Well, it's interesting that on this occasion, the biggest controversy seems to be on the fact that Nobel's being awarded for the wrong things, or at least they're not giving awards to some of the things that really need them, such as the environmental issues and public health. And the number of people who've worked on some amazing things to do with vaccines and so on that haven't been recognised, it was recently raised in a letter that was sent by E.O. Wilson, one of the greatest scientists of our time, and supported by a number of other scientists, saying it's exactly what we need. We need some more awards and keep it up to date. And they're kind of missing out on some of the key tricks.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm David Adam, one of The Guardian's growing army of environment correspondents. Now, the political party season is over and there may be a general election round the corner. So we thought it might make sense to have a look at how a Conservative government might fare on the environment. Now, despite strong rhetoric from Labour, its failure to deliver enough meaningful action has left many environmental campaigners disappointed. So would a Conservative government offer a greener future?
There needs to be something that binds the world into a commitment to reduce by 2 degrees C the amount of global warming that the scientists are forecasting. That needs to be the scale of the ambition. We should be guided by the scientists on this.
The Conservatives have set out a strong stall. At their conference last week, they restated their opposition to Heathrow's proposed third runway, and they promised to make that a manifesto commitment, along with blocks on further expansion in the southeast. A new high-speed rail network will take up some of the domestic slack between London and northern cities such as Manchester. Greg Clark, the Shadow Environment and Climate Change Secretary, talked up the need to modernise Britain's ageing electricity grid.
We need to upgrade it and have a smart grid that is interactive and can balance the changing demands of users and the changing sources of electricity generation. We'd mandate the National Grid to extend its network offshore, so that tidal, wave and offshore wind can be brought onshore to the customers that want to use it.
Central to the Conservative energy plans would be the adoption of a feed-in tariff. It would pay householders a fixed premium for spare electricity they generate. The system is credited with boosting uptake of renewables in countries like Germany. On a larger scale, they believe carbon capture and storage is reliable enough to force every coal power station to reduce its carbon emissions to the level of a modern gas plant. On housing, they have pledged to find the money for £6,500 worth of energy efficiency improvements to every home, and they want to generate enough methane from farm and food waste to replace some half of the natural gas used in central heating.
For communities that host wind farms, we'd let them keep 4 years of the business rates that those developments generate, so that goes straight into the community.
But there are reasons for both encouragement and alarm in the Conservative approach. Conservative MPs voted against green investment in the budget, according to their opponents in Parliament, and Conservative councils have opposed 60% of wind farms since Cameron became leader. While Green campaigners do not doubt the personal commitment of David Cameron and other senior Tories on the issue, there are still vocal elements within the party that remain distinctly off-message. Will Cameron be able to win them around? And for all political parties, it remains easier to set environmental targets than to meet them. The first may help get the Tories into government, but only the second will help to save the planet.
It falls to the Conservative Party at times like this to put Britain back on the right track. Ladies and gentlemen, we stand ready to do so again. Thank you very much.
Ian, you've got something to say about the Tories and science?
Yeah, I've obviously spent a lot of time in the last, well, 5 years, 6 years, going to the Science Select Committee meetings at the House of Commons. And, you know, when I first started, it was the Science and Technology Committee. Then that was abolished and it turned into the Innovation, Universities and Skills Committee. Now it's been reinstated and as the Science and Technology Committee again. But anyway, it was always the same bunch of people on this committee, and it's obviously Labour, Lib Dem and Tory MPs. The interesting thing over the last 2 years is when you turn up for these meetings, there'll be Labour and Lib Dem people there, and the Tory side is almost completely vacant. The only person who regularly turns up is the Shadow Science Minister. The rest, it's just empty chairs. And the other MPs are talk about this very openly, saying that they're just really ashamed, or they're just really embarrassed that the Tories can't make people go along to these meetings, which look at really fundamental stuff. I mean, they take on really serious issues that the government doesn't look at in any other way. And the only Tory, honestly, who makes a regular appearance is the guy who absolutely has to be there. And I think that's really telling. I mean, I hope it isn't.
Do you think
it's
a function of there being an opposition rather than...
No, I think it's a function of them being scientifically illiterate and not caring.
Fair enough. Ed, you work for the Science Media Centre, so you presumably have an opinion on how we should be liaising with government or working with the public. What do you reckon to this?
Well, I think with the Tories in particular, it's interesting. They do seem to have now come into the plan of actually having this kind of like background science stuff they're going to get everyone involved with, which is great. But there was a piece in Nature very recently where I believe they interviewed the shadow science minister, and he basically wasn't able to give much in the way of confidence about money for science. And no matter what you think about Lord Drayson, who's the current science minister, who I think personally I'm a big fan of, Paul Drayson is completely and utterly 100% with science, and his enthusiasm always comes through, whereas in this case there just was no evidence whatsoever that they really care.
Sort of a dire contrast to welcoming Obama into office and the excitement we had there. If you have any comments about funding or applied versus pure science, do go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly or post on our Facebook wall. BBC Radio 4 has announced it's to introduce a new science programme. Bosses say it'll be an irreverent, witty, unashamedly opinionated show. I wonder where they got that idea. What weighs 2 tonnes, travels at nearly 6,000 miles an hour and costs millions of dollars? The answer? NASA's LCROSS. LCROSS consists of 2 probes. They're a little bit broken up after smashing into the moon's surface on Friday. It was, of course, done deliberately, one after the other, to analyse what the lunar surface threw up. At the time of impact, our very own Ian Sample was live blogging.
All stations flight, 5 minutes to Centaur impact.
The images that NASA is sending back from the probe make the moon suddenly look enormously big and enormously hard. When you look up at night, it looks kind of cute and small. But you sort of get a sense of how hard this thing is going to hit. It's terrifying, actually.
All stations flight. Mark Centaur impact.
They're saying they think it's hit. They're looking for signs of the evidence, which is going to be this enormous plume of moon dust, which is going to rise up about 10 kilometres.
Please change NIR-1 to OPR-9. Over.
Copy NIR-1 to OPR-9. Command flight, set it up. Is that November or Mike?
November.
Science flight, confirm
November.
That November.
November.
IR.
We're not going to see the moon. I was going to see if it would be worth running out and looking and see if it's still there.
Sending MIR-1 at 1 hertz.
And the science team is directing the flight team to adjust the sampling rate of some of the instruments to fit within the 1 megahertz.
Ready with MIR-2 at 0.2, at 0.1.
The 1 megahertz signal limit.
For the last 3 minutes, what they call the shepherding part of the spacecraft has been zooming into the moon after the first part hit. And so it's been filming the carnage of the first impact. This one is just about to hit. For them, it might be a bit of an anticlimax. I mean, you think you have sort of 4 minutes apart, 2 5,500-mile-an-hour collisions, and then you're just waiting for your images to come back to see what you've actually done. Right, that's impact of the second shepherding part of the probe. Its last words were, according to NASA's Twitter, "That's it, ground, ha. I wonder if it'll be friends with me." LCROSS, both parts of LCROSS are now in thousands of pieces, undoubtedly across the moon's surface and kicking around at the bottom of this crater. That's the end of the mission, but the science begins now, because all of the data that those probes were taking on their way in for this head-on collision with the moon are now going to be pored over by scientists at NASA for quite a while yet.
There's more on the LCROSS mission in the latest Tech Weekly podcast, where we speak to NASA scientist Dr. Kim Eniko. You can find it at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And as more and more data comes out from NASA, you can follow announcements on what the suicide probes have discovered at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly.
Okay, and now back to Ed Sykes, our guest this week, to talk a little bit about human sex this time, having kind of roamed the bizarre nature of the animal and bug world. Have you talked about any of the particular proclivities of humans in your talk?
I do, actually. I talk about quite a few interesting bits. One of them is something that's actually been up in the news this week, which is to do with the effect of the pill. Now, I don't know whether you know about this, but there's been a lot of research done on the fact that humans and loads of other creatures are attracted to each other by their smell. And they think that this often comes from a section of the genes called the MHC complex, which basically gives you all your genetic information for your immune system. And it's thought each set of MHCs effectively gives you your own unique smell, to the point that you can actually recognise people by the smell on their T-shirt, and you can tell what kind of MHC complex they have. Obviously, you don't know this, it's all kind of subconsciously. But basically, they gave females the chance to smell T-shirts from different people and so on. This experiment was done a few times. And they discovered that women are looking for the smell of an MHC that doesn't match their own completely, but is similar. So it kind of works together so that any kids they might have would actually have the best type of immune system, one that can deal with any viruses and so on in the future. If you imagine a couple who... the woman was on the pill when she met a guy and everything was going really well. They've decided they're actually going to start settle down now, maybe try and have kids. The problem is that the pill actually influences her detection of smell to a point that it kind of subtly confuses her. So when she comes off the pill thinking everything's going to be great and going to start having kids now, she might actually find out she doesn't fancy him anymore because he now smells differently and realise their
MHCs don't
match up properly, which is not exactly what you're looking for. But also interestingly is the fact that people have wondered whether or not male humans have kind of developed anything to adapt to the way in which females supposedly sleep around. Because if all these other animals sleep around and have evolved ways of dealing with this, have humans done the same? Or are we faithful enough that it isn't really a problem? So there's a number of things they've done, one of which was they've actually looked at the penis itself. So in a number of animals, they've got things like spikes and they've got knobs on and all these bits and pieces, which are used to actually take semen out of the vaginal tract. So there's something like the damselfly, which has got all these bristles, really, really painful to look at. And it's actually supposed to remove about 99% of the sperm from inside the female.
What's the advantage of removing the sperm?
Oh, removing another male's sperm.
Oh, removing another male's sperm, I see.
If she's been sleeping around, then get rid of the other male's sperm and get your own in there. So a few scientists, being scientists, did what any normal person would do, and they basically modelled some vaginas, and they made some as accurately as possible viscous stuff like sperm, and they made a variety of different penis types, ranging from more like your kind of smooth cucumber style all the way through to something a bit more accurate like our own penises. And then of course they basically made them have sex with each other and then looked to see what the actual result was, and they basically found that the more like a normal penis that you expect with the head and the glands, it's more possible the sperm are able to be pulled out by the head. So with the more cucumber style, nothing really happens. You don't drag any sperm out. With the ones we've got pulled out by the glands. Now, of course, someone might say, how is it, you know, if you're pulling the sperm out the whole time, then you're going to end up not having enough in there. And the scientists, actually, it's a brilliant quote. They put in that you don't need to worry about too many withdrawals as long as a deposit is made very soon afterwards. But also, there's this whole question of should males react to the number, to what females are doing, so what their partners are doing. And they looked at this whole issue of what happens when your partner's been away. Because the kind of male psyche goes, well, obviously she's been cheating on me. I mean, what else would she be doing? And they found out that males will actually produce more sperm when they haven't seen their partner for a few days than if they've been seeing her every day but not being allowed to sleep with her. And somehow that's even the case even if the man's been masturbating while she's been away. The body seems to know, you know, that's just a waste. Don't waste the sperm. So it's very, very interesting. And what they also did was work out, well, so if they're actually doing this when the female's away, what about when they are influenced by the number of females that are around? If there are lots of females, then perhaps you make more sperm because you want to inseminate all of them. So they thought, how can we get a reaction of what males do when there are lots of females around and feeling aroused? The internet. So they went on and had a look at basically what men were doing when it came to watching porn. And they looked at the different types of porn that were on there and how much sperm males produced. And they basically looked at threesomes and had a look at to see what would happen if there were two females and a male, three females, or two males and one female. And really interestingly, it turns out that a man produces most sperm when it's two males and one female.
And what sort of range of research do you see? I mean, you know, some of this sounds quite sort of slightly hand-wavy, slightly evolutionary psychology. There's a sort of, there seems to be quite a lot of assumptions about what people think, how they act, going on in the background of this. How rigorous do you think this research is? Or
I think that when it comes to the animal stuff, it's far more rigorous. And when it comes to the human stuff, a lot of it is kind of very interesting, but doesn't necessarily influence what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. So I'm not saying that if you wanted to go home and really were desperate to have a kid, that maybe you should try watching threesomes with two men in it and one woman before having sex or anything like that. But I think it's something that's worth bearing
not
in mind.
Not looking at policies here, then.
No, I don't think we're quite ready for that stage yet.
Not public health, right.
But it's just it's something that's really worth bearing in mind, because so often we kind of think of evolution affecting animals and affecting everyone else, but we don't think of how it affects humans. We kind of think we're apart from it, whereas we're not. We've been under the same evolutionary pressures as many other animals for thousands and thousands of years. So it would be surprising if we didn't develop something that would actually cope with that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, many thanks to you, Ed. More details about his lecture can be found at ucl.ac.uk, and of course do go along. My thanks to you too, Ian Sample. Next week we have this chap on.
I'm Andy Russell. I work at the University of Manchester and I'm a weather scientist, a meteorologist.
Should we trust weather forecasts?
Yes, weather forecasts are brilliant. Given that the atmosphere is chaotic, it's almost a mystery to weather forecasters why they're so good. We don't understand how we can predict the weather on short timescales so well. And because of that, meteorologists have started looking at seasonal forecasts. And there was a lot of coverage in the press recently about the failure of the Met Office seasonal forecast for this summer. They said it was going to be warmer and drier than average. That was based on lots of runs of their weather forecast model. Now, basically, they got it pretty much on the nail. It was warmer than average. It was just a little bit wetter than average. So, I think they deserve some defence. And it was perhaps a PR failure, describing it as going to be a barbecue summer, rather than a failure of the science that was being used.
Yes, Andrew Russell will be telling us, amongst other things, whether it rains more at the weekend. Check him out, andrewrussell.co.uk. If you want to ask him any questions, get in touch. The best place, as always, is on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Alok will be back here as soon as possible, and he's terribly sad to have missed the penis podcast.